This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Richard Palmer, staff writer for the Trumpet Magazine, standing in for your regular host, Joel Hilliker. What is going on with American politics? At the two conventions last month, we saw not just a nation divided, but political parties divided. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller joins me to discuss the really important news from the party conventions and to explain why he believes the nation is going through a once-in-a-several-generations political earthquake and why this earthquake has dramatic ramifications for the country. War in space. It's the plotline for countless science fiction movies, but it's becoming more and more real by the day. America is developing a space mission force. Trumpet writer Callum Wood joins me via Skype from Australia to explain why this is too little, too late, and why space wars could actually have powerful real-world implications. No one, or at least a tiny few, actually like war, but mankind has proved hopeless at preventing it. Could pacifism actually be dangerous? We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about France's extreme aversion to war after World War I and how this pacifism actually led directly to World War II. It's important history with lots of lessons for today. And finally, can great men change the world? Or is there just not much that individual human beings can do about things? We'll conclude by talking about one more lesson from history and about how individuals can change it. America's politics is in turmoil. Over the last few weeks, both parties have had, they're officially nominated, they're presidential candidates, and it's already very clear that this isn't like every other election. Perhaps that's even more clear looking at it from outside the United States. Here, we generally don't pay much attention to primaries, conventions, etc., and then it kind of gets to the middle of November, and then we all go, oh yeah, America's got an election, who's running again? This time it's completely different. Outside of the U.S., even inside of the U.S., the media is obsessed with this election. The foreign media is both terrified of and fascinated by Donald Trump. So what in the world is going on with American politics this year? Well, to help us understand, we've got my good friend and Trumpet staff writer Andrew Miller. Andrew, good afternoon, or rather good morning.
Yeah, great to be here. So, like I said, I normally try not to bore our international audiences with American politics this early in the season too much. But this is really, now that the Republican and both the Democratic national election are both done, a really significant election, and that you may be seeing the beginning of a political realignment, which is something that's only happened six times before in American history, about once every half century. And they're hard to predict, but they definitely have very far-reaching consequences, both for the nation and the world.
So what is the more immediate kind of news out of these conventions that makes you forecast a major political realignment or say that that's what's going on here?
Well, we've definitely seen at both conventions more division, not just between the two parties, but even sometimes, in some ways, even more so within the two parties this election. One of the big news at the Republican National Convention is when Senator Ted Cruz refused to endorse Donald Trump. And that had caused quite a bit of tension within the end of that convention. And then that was even more so at the Democratic Convention when you had like two dozen Bernie Sanders delegates actually walk out of the room in protest of Hillary Clinton's nomination. And it just really brings up the fact, I think, to clarify it to like the international audience, is that if America had like a parliamentary system like Britain or most of the European nations do, we probably would have 4 to 5 political parties over here, just based off the natural diversity of ideas within America. The reason we have two is just because how are the electoral colleges structured. I mean, you have to get over half the electoral votes to win the nomination. And since the states have a winner-take-all system in allotting those electoral votes, just structurally it makes sense that the political parties have to align themselves into an opposition group and a pro-administration group. It's really the only effective strategy to win an election. So we do still have We do still have political coalitions in America like they do in Europe. We just, all the coalition wrangling happens before the election instead of after. It's in the primary season. So when you look at we call it the Democratic Party, even though it's more like a Democratic coalition between like the Democratic Socialist supporters of Bernie Sanders, mm-hmm. Or the more corporatist welfare supporters of Hillary Clinton, who in a parliamentary system would almost certainly be separate parties. Here they join forces and they work together before the election to get the 50% majority they need to run against the opposition.
And what would happen if, say, there was a third party and neither party did get 50% of the votes in the Electoral College?
Right, and that's actually one of my that's true. If one party didn't get 50% of the votes, it would go to the House of Representatives, and then they would vote on one vote per state, which in this case, since there are more conservative states than Democratic states by a large margin, they have fewer people live in those states, but there are more of them. If it ever went to the House of Representatives, it would assuredly be a Republican victory.
Okay, so what makes this election different? What's the historic? How does that fit in with this historic context that you've been talking about?
Right. Well, as I mentioned before, there have been a few times in American history where the parties have realigned. Normally, people vote the same way because of how the two-party system works. There's really two ways a third party can rise to prominence on the American political scene. And I can't take credit for this analogy. It comes from Paul David Miller at The Federalist. But I thought it was just a really great way of describing this, as he has the guerrilla theory of third parties and the demon possession theory of third parties.
So
basically, the guerrilla theory, probably the best example of the guerrilla theory, was the birth of the Republican Party in the first place, where we had a two-party system. We had the Democrats, who were pro-slavery, and the Whigs, who were kind of wishy-washy on slavery back in 1850. Mm-hmm. The Republicans established themselves as an anti-slavery party, came on the political scene, got enough votes that they were a third party, but the system was unstable having a third party within the Electoral College, which basically meant that the Whigs and the Republicans had to duke it out like a pair of fighting gorillas until one killed the other and took its place as the new alpha male on the political scene as the second party. So then you had the Democrats and the Republicans. The Republicans just came in and pushed the Whig Party out of existence. The second way you can do that is what's called the demon possession theory, or just the possession theory. And that's what happened in the 1960s, where before that you had the Progressive Party had come on the scene as a third political party. And they tried to use the guerrilla tactic to take out the Democratic Party, kill it, and take its place, and couldn't do it. After Wallace's campaign failed in 1948, they just realized they'd never take the Democratic Party's place. So they tried a new tactic and just all joined the Democratic Party and completely changed its platform from the inside. So that's the analogy. They said, well, technically the corpse of the Democratic Party apparatus is still around. It's animated by the ideas and the spirit of the Progressive Party.
And we're seeing something similar.
And this is really similar, is that the Bernie Sanders campaign, because Bernie Sanders, he's never been a Democrat until this election. And I think he's actually going back to being an independent candidate mm-hmm. Since he failed to get the nomination. So he and his supporters, they really tried to push the Democratic Party further left. That would be like a classic possession tactic. And to large effect, they've succeeded. Even though Sanders didn't get the nomination, the Clinton campaign has had to track much further left than she normally would have in order to try to unify the party. And even that hasn't completely worked, because Bernie Sanders supporters normally come in two flavors. You've got the millennials, the college-educated millennials we hear so much about. But there's also the elderly, white, working-class male who worked on the auto line in Detroit and is upset that all our jobs are being outsourced to China and Japan. and is wanting more like pro working class policies. Who and a lot of those people are actually starting to even go over to Republican, like Donald Trump, because I mean he's got his ideas about putting tariffs on China and all these protectionist policies that do favor some of those older Bernie Sanders supporters. So they're even pushing the transforming the Republican Party a bit as well.
So do you, right. So do you see then Trump doing the same thing to the Republicans? Like is that to use that terminology, demon possession takeover of the Republicans?
To definitely a certain extent, because I think there were three pillars to the conservative style of like Ronald Reagan or Margaret Thatcher. They were fairly aggressive on foreign policy or military policy, pretty libertarian on economic policy, and fairly well conservative or traditional on like moral policy. Trump's changed all three of those pillars in the Republican Party. He's an isolationist on foreign policy. He's a protectionist and pro-socialized medicine on economic policy. And actually, the only libertarian point he takes is normally on moral policy, abortion, homosexual marriage. He just doesn't really care to comment on those things all that much.
So why is this all happening now? Because you've got the takeover of the Democratic Party, you've got the takeover of the Republican Party. I mean, even what you described with the Democratic Party, you've got pretty much exactly the same thing happening in the Labour Party in the UK. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has pretty much done the same thing that Bernie Sanders has done, to the point that Labour's traditional members and leaders are now thinking that they're going to have to leave the Labour Party and form their own party. So this seems like it's a trend. We see it very strongly in both political parties in America. We see it in other countries. Why is this all happening now?
Right. Well, there is definitely, I think, worldwide a pushback against like what they term establishment politics. They're upset with how things are going. Immigration's been a big driver and all across Europe and America, which really plays into like Donald Trump's more nationalist policies. Mm-hmm. And you really do see that as that even though the Trump style of conservatism, it's not as socialist. It's more socialist than Reagan or Thatcher by far, but it's not as socialist as the Democrats. But the big dividing line, it looks like, between Republicans and Democrats here is more of a dividing line between globalism and nationalism. And you definitely see that across continental Europe right now, too, where in both cases it means an American withdrawal from the world scene. In the Democrats' case, it's more of a socialist philosophy that it's not fair for one nation to be more powerful than others. So they want every nation on the global scene to have equal say in how they make policies. Where in the more like the Trump Donald Trump case, it is more of just a more traditional isolationist, just withdraw from the world, take care of our own problems first.
Right. And while we're talking about the policies of these new parties, what are the new parties then? What are these two parties transforming into or American politics changing into?
Right. Because we may actually have some third party support in this coming election, because a lot of the more libertarian minded Republicans,
they don't have a home in the Republican Party anymore.
Yeah, they don't have a home there. So there are they're actually saying that like Gary Johnson's Libertarian Party, he might actually make the debate stage this year. You have to get 15% to get televised debates, but he's getting close. But as they move out and then the Republicans track further, more like protectionist, isolationist, to try to pick up some of the older demographic of the Bernie Sanders supporters, you may get three parties that just have to duke it out guerrilla style. And it will definitely be the Libertarians who'd lose that. But yeah, you will start to see more the two parties in America being more like a nationalist, isolationist, protectionist party under the Republicans versus the Democrats that are more of like a socialist and globalist, and not globalist in the fact that they really want to be really involved in the world scene, but more globalist in the fact that they want international bodies to be able to tell America what to do.
That's fascinating. So the basically the classical liberalism of the I guess that's the term we'd use over here. I think in America it might be called something slightly different. But that classical liberalism of the founding fathers of social conservatism, coupled with a belief generally, you know, keeping the government out of the economy, basically has no place in either party in what's coming.
Right. It is pretty much that very much like the standpoint of just let the market work, that whole like Adam Smith style of economy, that if it doesn't die out completely this election, it looks like it might be forced to go a third party, which can't get more than 15%, so it won't win any elections and then we'll see what happens to it from there. And then the other of course big concern is that like I said, we've had six party alignments before, party realignments, where the parties kind of change platforms in history, and they usually get kind of messy. And the fact that, I mean, the Civil War started on a party realignment, in that the Republican Party came, like I said, that guerrilla style. They killed the Whig Party, took over, took a very anti-slavery stance, and which just convinced that the other party that they needed to leave the nation. Other party realignments haven't been as bad, but like when the anti-Vietnam protest and all like the hippie movement in the 1960s, that kind of kicked off a party realignment. I think the War of 1812 was another party realignment. The Federalists were upset that we're at war with Britain because they were mostly factory owners in New England who made a lot of money trading with Britain. And so they died out over that war, and which gave rise to the Whigs in the first place. So a lot of these party realignments, they not only does it mean a withdrawal from the world scene, but they oftentimes are like a herald of civil unrest within the nation.
So potentially big consequences. Thank you, Andrew. We've been talking to Andrew Miller, a staff writer for the Trumpet.com and the Trumpet magazine. I assume we'll probably see some of this on an article in the coming weeks.
Yeah, probably so. After, not this week, but yeah, by next week we should have something up on it.
Great. Looking forward to reading it. Thanks for talking to us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
The voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
One of my favorite areas of the news to watch is outer space. You have stories of incredible discoveries or mind-blowing achievements, but increasingly we're seeing another type of news story make our headlines more and more coming from outer space. Space warfare. Now, my next guest is Callum Wood, a Trumpet correspondent in Brisbane, Australia. Good evening, Callum.
Hi, nice to be here.
Or I should say near Brisbane, Australia. You've written an article called Space Warfare. Now, I'm sure you find this a really fascinating subject, judging by the fact you've chosen to write about it. But why is this important for someone, say, who has their feet very firmly planted on the ground?
Well, you know, like you said, I do take an interest in this sort of thing. I was always a fan of Star Wars growing up, but I never realized that I would live through an age where some aspects of that actually do seem to become a reality. And it does make a big difference for us in an increasingly technological age, especially in Western cultures. We have an increasing reliance on space, whether it be satellite technology or everything down to GPS and the military, especially in America, relies heavily on space and space technology.
So what are some specific ways that the world's militaries rely on access to space?
Well, I think one of the big aspects is GPS. Now, we all think GPS when we're driving around in our car trying to find certain locations, but the military especially needs GPS. It's vital for navigation, for knowing where you are on a battlefield. It's a crucial component, and the use of it has really given America the edge in its military conflicts around the world. And beyond GPS, a lot of satellite-guided weaponry, especially for the US, it's very crucial. It really does give them the edge on the battlefield. America has the ability to pinpoint targets down to a very narrow margin around the world. And by doing so, it creates almost a buffer zone. The US personnel are less needed. The boots on the ground certainly have their place, but having GPS and satellite-guided missiles and weaponry gives America that opportunity to avoid face-to-face conflict and strike from a distance. And it gives America that important geopolitical presence around the world. America can make its influence known through the use of satellite technology. And going further beyond that, even when they aren't necessarily engaging in warfare, active face-to-face warfare or conflict, America uses satellites, of course, we all know, to a great extent with its spy networks. America has the ability to see what's happening around the globe in a very detailed way. Other nations are certainly starting to pick up on that, as we will talk about with Russia and China and the like. But America certainly has that ability to observe from a distance. And then if they do see a threat, oftentimes we see it in places like Somalia or elsewhere, in the Middle East, places like Iraq, Syria, they have the ability to strike from a distance. And by doing so, avoid that face-to-face conflict, keep the casualties down to a minimum.
Great. And so then this use of space then has really played a major role in US power and hence the world as we see it. We're all affected by this, I guess, in that we're all being kept safe the world order that we see it is being kept in place by a lot of these technologies. So what are some of the news stories then that that drove you to write this article, Space Warfare?
Well, there was one in particular, Richard, that I noticed that piqued my interest. And the story itself is, well, the US has been the leader in space technology for years and years. But all of a sudden, we've seen the sudden rise of Russia and China, especially in recent years, China, and their space capabilities. And that's prompted the US to start up some new initiatives to try and keep ahead of the curve, you might say, and keep that edge over other nations. And so recently, the military released this white paper report, and it's called Space Mission Force, Developing Space Warfighters for Tomorrow. It's a very sci-fi sounding name. But basically, this program, it's been a year in development, and it's an 8-page report. What it does, it's training up personnel for space warfare tomorrow. And the idea is these people will be trained in a variety of situations where aggressive warfare is carried out in space. And that really caught my attention because I thought to myself, well, it should have been a report to deal with the threat today, not tomorrow, because the Russians and the Chinese, well, they've risen on the scene. They're already out there now. They have the capability to knock down US satellites, to engage in space warfare and really change not only how things are conducted in space, but also on the battlefields down on Earth as well. And so that's why I really thought this Space Mission Force paper that's come out, while it's admirable to see the US trying to keep ahead of the curve, it's almost too little too late in a way.
So maybe first we'll talk about some of the threats America faces, and that before we just go into some of the recommendations that paper makes. So you mentioned the advances that China has made. What can you give us some more about exactly what China is working on right now?
Well, China, over the years they've been developing a lot of missile technology, and on July 25 they actually released some video footage of their very first satellite interception. Now, this interception, this land to space interception, it was carried out back in 2010, and they've never released any official footage until today. And obviously the timing plays into China's regional aspirations and their goals, and a lot of people see it as a part of their saber rattling at the moment going on, especially in South China Sea, with tensions so high between China and the US at the moment. But the fact is that this occurred back in 2010, and since then China's carried out a few more of these missile launches and interceptions and tests. There was another one in 2013, for instance. And China calls these missiles a trump card against the United States. And it's very easy to see why. They have the capability now of defeating US spy technology and posing a incredible threat, not only to US satellites, but to the US way of life. I mean, not only military, but civilian. We rely so heavily on satellite technology. And China now has developed these missiles whereby they can knock down satellites almost around the globe. And so that's an incredible threat to the US now. That's why the US has been prompted to start up these initiatives like Space Mission Force, because they're having to face a direct threat now from nations that once just couldn't reach them. It was just a matter of fact that a Chinese missile could only go so far. But now almost all of the United States satellites are within range of Chinese missiles.
Yeah, I thought the point that you made just at the start of that answer is, you know, the timing of this is really interesting. July 25th, in the midst of all this, you know, the Hague warning about the ruling on the South China Sea, you know, like you were saying at the start, it shows just the very real world implications of this. They're worried about the South China Sea, and so they release a video demonstrating their space warfare capabilities. So maybe you could tell us a bit about what the Russians are doing. So I know they've got a few slightly different initiatives to the Chinese. And then, of course, decades and decades of experience operating in space.
Well, you're right. Yes, the Russians have been around a lot longer than the Chinese have. And they haven't pursued necessarily as reckless or aggressive policies with missile technology that the Chinese have, though no doubt they probably have the capabilities. But the Russians, perhaps building off Cold War days, have a lot of tracking technology, which in its own way poses a really big threat to the United States. The United States launches a lot of spy satellites, very costly satellites that they put up there, and oftentimes they'll try and hide from the public where these satellites are and what they're filming, for very obvious reasons. For instance, a lot of the launches of spy satellites, the video feed that the public has access to will often cut out after a certain time, a couple of minutes, just so that people can't track these things and find out where they are. But of course, the Russians have the ability to do so. And they've openly bragged about it. In fact, they've actually threatened and followed through on those threats to expose United States spy satellites. The Russian newspaper Izvestia said that Moscow is actually planning on publishing a lot of this information on US spy satellites in an effort to, quote-unquote, level the playing field. And you can really see what that would do. If Russia publishes this information, then other nations with capabilities like Europe or like China, for instance, China has the missile capability, but we don't know if they've got the detecting abilities. Well, Russia might do the hard work for them. But the thing is, it's not just the Russians that are getting these capabilities now. It's actually becoming easier and easier as people, the general public, get more access to technology themselves. You have people out there who their hobby is tracking satellites. For instance, one recent US satellite, a spy satellite, it had only been up in the air for a few days before an Australian blogger, he again was a satellite tracker, he put it in his personal blog on the internet for all to see. He tracked it down in a number of days, this spy satellite that's supposed to be state of the art, launched in secrecy, and he found it within a couple of days. So it shows it's not just the Russians, but everyone is now has more ability to track down these satellites.
Mm-hmm. Now these satellites, we know that they're and they're incredibly fragile. I have in front of me just a picture from the space station, picture released just in May, where a paint fleck hit the glass and left probably a fingernail-sized dent or crack in that glass there. And you know, you've got all of this debris moving around in space so quickly. I think you, in this article, you talked about some of the incredibly devastating effects that a kind of a chain reaction in space could cause when you've got more and more of this debris flying around. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, that's why I mentioned China's satellite tests or their missile tests as being quite reckless, because they threaten what's called the Kessler syndrome. And that's that chain reaction. You can imagine almost like a nuclear reaction. If you destroy one satellite in space that's traveling at 1,000 miles an hour or whatever speed it might be, it's very fast. And like you mentioned, that little fleck of paint was able to cause a dent in a satellite. Well, consider what a nut or a bolt would do. Very small, but traveling at 1,000 miles an hour. And imagine if that hit the International Space Station or the Hubble telescope. Imagine the astronomical damage that would do. It would tear the satellite to pieces, which would, in turn, send hundreds, if not thousands, more pieces of space debris hurtling around in space. And a lot of these don't fall to the ground for a long time. They sit up there in orbit. And gradually over the years, as we've explored space a little bit more and launched more satellites, every time we launch, a little bit more debris is left behind. And so now we have this great blanket of debris whizzing around in space above our heads. And you made a point yourself in the January article, I remember you wrote, on the subject of space warfare and space advances. And you said that should something like this happen, well, no one has as much to lose as America, because no one else relies on satellite technology quite as much. For instance, someone in the deep darks of Africa is not going to care a whole lot because satellites start falling from the sky, because they don't really affect their life on a broad scale. But for the United States or for Britain or any of the more advanced nations of this world that rely so heavily on technology, well, you can just imagine suddenly not having the ability to guide yourself around on the battlefield, not having the ability to use your missiles in the way that you would want to. And even on a more personal note, your television, the way you drive in your car, you know, everyday life would be affected by this. And that's what makes the Kessler syndrome so devastating. Not only would it change the military battlefield, it would change everyone's way of life as a whole.
Wow. So what's America doing about this then? And you mentioned that report at the start. What are some of their recommendations or points they're implementing already?
For things like the Kessler syndrome, there's not a great deal you can do. But as far as dealing with Russia and China, we have the Space Mission Force, which is an effort to train up new cadets and train up personnel in the art of space warfare. But these forces, these initiatives, they're almost too little too late at this stage. As I've mentioned, China has the capability to knock down the US satellites and such. And the Russians have the ability to expose them already. So, and once they're up there, space is a very, there's not a great deal of margin. You can't get up there and hide a satellite in open space. It just can't be done. And so there's not a great deal of ways that you can get around some of these problems.
Now, of course, most of our listeners or all of our listeners will be aware, we talk a lot about news in light of Bible prophecy, and we use the Bible to guide our news watching and to guide our what we look at and the headlines that we examine. So maybe you could just give us a very brief overview as we wind up this segment of just how this subject relates to Bible prophecy and what the Bible indicates regarding the subject of space warfare.
Well, we know for a fact that the United States itself is not going to be a dominant power in a number of conflicts that we can read about in Revelation, in Zechariah, and elsewhere, these battles between great world powers, the US isn't mentioned. It isn't on the scene at that time. And that in itself, it raises a lot of questions. If the US has all this space technology, if it has the means to strike on the far side of the globe, well, surely if the US is not a factor anymore, a lot of those abilities have to be taken away as well. But beyond that, there's just a few curious things I like to think about. For instance, in Zechariah and such, we see these world powers coming together to fight outside Jerusalem. And they're not fighting with precision-guided missiles or nuclear weapons at that time. No, it says that these nations, they're coming together with troops, with tanks, with, well, it doesn't say tanks specifically, obviously, but it describes this war where you have thousands upon thousands of soldiers flowing into these areas. And looking at it from a logical standpoint, well, if you were a military and you had 100,000 soldiers, and you wouldn't want to put them all together in a raid on one battlefield when you know your enemy has missiles capable of being launched around the globe. So to me, it sounds like that threat isn't there anymore. Now, I'm not saying that for certain, but it looks like these armies can come together to fight against one another, not worrying about what's going on over their heads.
Great point. Well, thanks so much for this interview, Callum. Really enjoyed it. Fascinating material. Thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour.
How do you prevent war? No one is exactly a huge fan, but throughout history, mankind has proved absolutely terrible at stopping war, at producing peace. I'm joined now by trumpet writer Kieran Underwood, who's just written an article about how not to prevent war. Good morning, Kieran.
How's it going?
Hi. Now, you wrote an article about France's absolutely disastrous attitude to war and how it led not only to World War II, but to their absolutely humiliating defeat right at the start of that war. So what drove you to bring this history to us?
Well, there's a number of reasons. The first one, the initial one, was I was reading a book. It's a book by a man named Thomas Sowell. Now, the title of the book is called Intellectuals in Society, and his thesis is that there are a number of ideas that espoused by intellectuals time and time again, and these ideas turn out not to be only wrong, but actually very dangerously wrong. So he talked a little bit about what I wrote about in this article in his book. So I went and researched it deeper, and it really is an interesting subject. There were two different mindsets really in World War I and World War II for France. And one of them worked out not great, but better. And then one of them worked out disastrously. So it's always a good idea to figure out which one should we use in the future.
Mm-hmm. Great. So maybe you could go over with us what were these two attitudes that France had in World War I and then how they approached things the next time round in World War II?
Okay, so I think what's good to understand as well is that the two attitudes were really directed by the intellectuals of the time, the elites. And in one time before World War I, I think they got it right, the attitude. And then before World War II, I think they got it wrong. So France had a very patriotic view of what they could do as a country. Of course, they had a lot of colonialism at the time. And they were about they wanted to spread democracy and spread what they thought were the ideals. And then after World War One, and the horrific losses that they suffered, 1.4 million of them never came back. And the attitude turned from patriotic to appeasement and to pacifism and not wanting to start any conflicts because war had become the enemy instead of nations.
And so how did this new attitude that war is the enemy, what effect did that have? Was this something that was just among, just kind of talked about among the elites, or were there concrete actions that kind of sprang from that way of thinking?
There definitely were concrete actions at the start, of course, of every single movement that we see. Even today, we see the same thing. It comes from the top and then it trickles down. So what we saw as World War I was running down, there were a large group of teachers and intellectuals in France that were very, very upset with the patriotic view. They thought that having their people go out and die for the country was a waste. And of course, it was a horrific waste, but it was not started by France, of course. So that view was very, very prominent in the teachers' unions of France. And there's a history professor, and her name is Mona Siegel, and she wrote about that. She said that the government actually tried to silence this small movement at the beginning, and they would even sometimes take them out of their jobs if they were teaching for their pacifist views. Afterwards, though, when all these people came back and they were maimed and they were injured, and people's sons didn't come back from the war, people really attached to pacifist views. Textbooks were rewritten straight after World War One. The textbooks were very patriotic about how French men had gone out and saved the country and saved Europe. And a few years after that, they were called bellicose, these textbooks. They were said to be creating conflict, and they were replaced by textbooks that said we shouldn't condemn Germany, we shouldn't have a warlike spirit, and we should move towards disarmament, pacifism, and those ideas.
And then this way of thinking gained international traction, didn't it? I think you talked about the Kellogg Brand Pact in your article. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about that as well.
Yeah, that's a very funny one. Most people nowadays look on it with a significant amount of scorn because it really did nothing. When they were discussing it, this was an act to pretty much outlaw any acts of war. And when I was reading about it, there's plenty of very intelligent columnists at the time who were saying it's not worth the paper that it's written on, and that I remember one funny comment where the whole of mankind had been trying to outlaw war for eternity, pretty much. But these people at the Kellogg and Briand Pact, they would be able to do it by just writing it down, and that would solve the problem of war.
Right, we all know by now that it failed pretty spectacularly. So how did this then attitude drive France's response as Germany and Nazi Germany kind of came on the scene and started demanding war, essentially?
Well, at the time, it's easy for us to see the red flags that preceded Germany's advances in Czechoslovakia and with Austria and with going into the Rhineland and militarizing that. But what I thought is the best way to describe how the French were able to rationalize it was through what Thomas Sowell, who I talked about earlier, calls one day at a time rationalism. So if you look at every single one of the advances which Germany made, they can all be rationalized if you don't look at them in terms of the big picture. If you look at their walking into the Rhineland, which was a territory which separated France and Germany, they would rationalize it by saying, "Oh, Germany has the right to self-determine where they cannot live or where they cannot put people."
Right, because the Rhineland was part of Germany, and people in the West were talking about that as you know, Germany marching troops in their own backyard was how it was described.
One of the headlines at the time was Germany, something to do with Germany has invaded and then dashed Germany, as if breaking these treaties that had been set up internationally was something that was totally normal, and that there was no consequences to World War One, and Germany could act as any other nation could, even though they had a completely different history. Mm-hmm. So if you could look at the events without putting them into their context, which is what France wanted to do because they just wanted to avoid conflict, then it was easy for those intellectuals to tell the population that it was not something they should be worried about.
And so then as these steps kept coming, eventually, of course, France was forced into war, went in alongside Britain when Germany invaded Poland. And then, did this attitude, then how did that play into how France actually responded when it was actually invaded by Germany?
Well, a few years before Poland, the public actually started to turn away from what the intellectuals had been feeding them. So Poland was invaded, of course, in 1939. And in 1939, the public opinion was that 76% of the population was willing to do, the French population, this is, to do something to defend mm-hmm. Poland. But still, the elites and the people in the politicians at that time didn't have the will to do anything. They hadn't changed their minds. The population had, because they could really see the danger. Mm-hmm. But by that time, their defensive army and the amount of money they were putting into their army was not enough to maintain what had previously been an advantage over Germany, because of the roughly 15 years of pacifist ideas, they had not been on the offensive in building up arms. Really, a lot of pacts had been made to decrease the amount of arms that France had, and Germany, of course, was doing the exact opposite. So when it comes to invasion in 1940, suddenly, instead of France having a major advantage, suddenly Germany and France are pretty much on even terms, apart from the fact that Germany has a will to do something and France does not. Mm-hmm.
So what then are the lessons for us from this history? Why, I mean, we talked about this a little at the start, I guess, but why do we really need to pay attention to this?
Well, I think one of the most important lessons, and as I wrote in as the thesis of this article, is that we should not have a willingness to follow the intellectuals of the day. That doesn't mean that you can't follow people who are intellectuals, but that means that we shouldn't be on this pendulum swing, which often occurs after big events or where there will be a drastic change in the thought of the day. And Paul Johnson wrote about this. He said, "The study of history is a powerful antidote to contemporary arrogance." And this is usually the arrogance of intellectuals. "It's humbling to discover how many of our glib assumptions, which have been novel and plausible, have been tested before, not once but many times and in innumerable guises, to be discovered at great human cost to be wholly false." So what we saw in France was something that we have seen before. Pacifism did not originate in France. And it didn't originate in 1940 either. It had happened hundreds, possibly even more times than that before in history, where a nation had said, we would rather appease someone than have to go and perform a very, very unwanted conflict. So the lesson to us would be, just because intellectuals say something and it's new and it sounds very smart, the idea has probably been tested, and we need to look to see what the results of that were in the past.
Great, wise words. Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Kieran. This is in an article that Kieran has written for the Trumpet website, and I believe also should be in the Trumpet print coming up soon. It's titled, so at the moment, Intellectuals, Dangerous Ideas, and France's Six-Week Defeat. So keep your eyes peeled for that on the Trumpet website, and we should have that up soon. Thanks for talking to us today, Kieran.
Thanks for interviewing me.
It's time for today's last word.
In his former Prophets book, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry begins a chapter quoting from an article written by George Will in 2001. And this article states, "When history is taught at all nowadays, often it is taught as the unfolding of inevitabilities, of vast impersonal forces. The role of contingency in history is disparaged so that students are inoculated against the undemocratic notion that history can be turned in its course by great individuals." And in that book, Mr. Flurry writes, "Great individuals do turn the course of history." And these quotes came to mind recently when I finished going over Andrew Roberts' recent book on Napoleon called Napoleon the Great. Roberts in this book spends about 800 pages going over Napoleon's life. Of course, Napoleon did so much that was wrong. Andrew Roberts points out that there were around 3 million military deaths and around 1 million civilian deaths in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. And he writes that Napoleon must, of course, take much of the responsibility for these deaths. But Napoleon was also a man who had a huge impact on the world. Churchill called Napoleon the greatest man of action born in Europe since Julius Caesar. And Roberts wrote in this book that Napoleon Bonaparte was the founder of modern France and gave his name to an age. He came to power through a military coup only 6 years after entering the country as a virtually penniless political refugee. Napoleon fought 60 battles and sieges and lost only 7. Roberts also writes that even if he had not been one of the great conquerors, Napoleon would still be one of the giants of modern history, for his civil achievements equaled his military ones and far outlasted them. Roberts argued that were it not for a few key errors, Napoleon would have founded an empire stretching from the English Channel to the River Niemen in Belarus and Lithuania. And at the end of all that, this is what Roberts had to say in the final paragraph of his book. "Napoleon's life and career stands as a rebuke to determinist analysis of history, which explain events in terms of vast impersonal forces and minimize the parts played by individuals." You could see why that immediately made me think of that quote Mr. Flurry used, and I think Roberts is deliberately hearkening back to that point that George Will made. There are so many lessons that we can learn from Napoleon's life, and Mr. Gerald Flurry draws many of them out in his book, How to Be an Overcomer. And this lesson that Roberts draws attention to is certainly an important one. I thought it was a great and even motivational way for Roberts to finish his book. Napoleon did so much, much of it not good, but he certainly changed the world. He was a man of vigorous activity. How much more can we accomplish? Is it possible that individuals can do so much? In 1815, at 45 years old, Napoleon surrendered to the British ship HMS Bellerophon. There, the crew got to observe this man closely. George Home, a midshipman on the Bellerophon, he wrote in his memoirs that Napoleon showed us what one little human creature like ourselves could accomplish in a span so short. When talking about this article that I quoted at the start of this segment in a Key of David program, Mr. Flurry said, That's what history thunders to us time and time again, that we can lift our personal lives out of drudgery and failure. That's what these history books tell us. Now, we absolutely do need God's help. We are still very limited in what we can do alone. And again, look at Napoleon. He accomplished so much, but so much of what he accomplished was evil. To truly leave lasting, monumental, purely good accomplishments, we do need God's help. But when we see history, we do see that it is turned on its course by great individuals. Can we do that to the history of our families, to our lives? Absolutely we can. I'm Richard Palmer, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Hopefully you've enjoyed listening as much as I've enjoyed putting this together. You can send any comments on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. A big thank you once again to my guests, Andrew Miller, Callum Wood and Kieran Underwood. And also a big thank you to our technical crew, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. Thanks for listening to us here on Trumpet Hour, and until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.